Welcome to the Employment Law and HR Podcast with your host, Allison Cauley.
Hello and welcome to this episode number 44 of the Employment Law and HR Podcast. I'm your host, Allison Cauley. I'm an employment lawyer and HR specialist. And in this episode of the podcast, I'm going to be continuing the series on redundancy. This is part 5 of a 6-part series focusing on redundancy. So I'm going to get straight into the content and talk to you about redundancy payments. Okay, so we've been through in the previous episodes about how you get to the point of deciding which employees are going to be made redundant and the process, all of those sorts of things. And now you're at the point where you're deciding what you need to pay your employees in terms of redundancy pay. Well, there are two types of payments that can be made. One is the statutory redundancy payment, which is set out by law and which you're legally required to pay. And the second is enhanced redundancy pay, which I'm going to talk about later on, which is where you have either a contractual obligation to pay an enhanced payment or you make an enhanced payment at your discretion. When you dismiss an employee for redundancy and they meet the eligibility criteria for a redundancy payment, you're legally required to pay them statutory redundancy, which is set out by a particular formula that you have to follow, which I'll come on to shortly. In order to qualify for a redundancy payment, there are three things that need to be in place. One, the person needs to be an employee. So they have to be an employee in order to qualify for redundancy pay. If they're a worker or self-employed person, then they won't be qualifying. The second is they have to have been employed continuously for a minimum of 2 years. So an employee who's been employed for less than 2 years is made redundant would not have an entitlement to a statutory redundancy payment. And finally, they have to have been dismissed by reason of redundancy. I know it seems obvious, but I'm going to tell you anyway. In order to claim statutory redundancy payment, the reason for their dismissal must have been redundancy. And there are some circumstances where that is in dispute, and I will talk to you about that again shortly. An employee can also become eligible for a redundancy payment in a situation where they are laid off or put on short-time working, and there's a specific process that an employee needs to follow in those circumstances in order to claim statutory redundancy pay. I'm not going to talk about it in this episode of the podcast, but I will do an episode in the future about short-time working and laying staff off, and that will cover those points. Okay, so you've established that you have an employee who's being made redundant. You need to then work out if they've got 2 years continuous service. Now, you think that might be easy. Well, actually, in some cases where an employee may be on the cusp of reaching the 2-year period, it might not be so easy to work out. And there are certain circumstances in which the timing for continuous employment can be modified. In the case of employees who work for the NHS or for local government, for instance, then there are particular agreements in place which cover continuous service for those types of employees. So if you work in the NHS or local government and you move from one organisation, so one NHS trust to another, or from one local authority to another, and there's no gap or no significant gap in the period of service, an employee would be deemed to have continuous service from their previous local authority or trust. So local government service and NHS service is treated as continuous if there's no significant gap, regardless of which authority or trust they work for. So that's one circumstance. Another circumstance in which continuous employment may be varied is where somebody works overseas. So in certain circumstances, the period of time in which they work overseas may be excluded for calculating their continuous service. Now, if that applies to you or to any of your staff before going through the redundancy process or making any payments, it's worth getting some specific advice to see if that's applicable to your staff. Another scenario in which the dates and periods of continuous service may be varied is where an employee is given insufficient notice or no notice in accordance with what's required by law, so the statutory notice periods. In that case, the relevant date for calculating continuous service will be extended. So for example, you have an employee who has been employed for just under 2 years, and the statutory minimum notice that's required is 1 week for each continuous year of employment. So that employee is entitled to 1 week's notice. In this scenario, if the employer, in order to avoid paying redundancy, for instance, tells the employee that they're being dismissed for redundancy with immediate effect, and they've got a week to go until they would reach their 2 year continuous service. So their 2 year anniversary is 1 week away. But because the employer has failed to give them the statutory notice, then they haven't reached the continuous service for redundancy pay. In those circumstances, what happens is the relevant date for calculating whether they're entitled to redundancy pay is extended by that week. So in fact, the employer won't actually get away with not paying statutory redundancy pay. The same is said in relation to calculating continuous service for the actual amount of statutory redundancy pay. If an employee is on the cusp of an anniversary for their continuous employment, and they're not provided with sufficient notice, so not in accordance with the law, then the period is also extended. So let's just say again, somebody has been employed for 7 years, they would be entitled to 7 weeks' notice. They're dismissed with no notice by reason of redundancy, and it's 7 weeks away, or 6 weeks away, for instance, from their 8th year anniversary, which would mean they would be entitled to potentially a whole other week's worth of statutory redundancy pay. In those circumstances, the relevant date for calculating redundancy pay is extended to what would be the end of the legal notice period. So again, the reason for that is to prevent employers trying to get around having to pay even more redundancy pay or redundancy pay at all by failing to give notice and, for instance, paying in lieu of notice. So for the purposes of calculating redundancy pay, the relevant date is important. So establishing the relevant date in all other circumstances is normally the date on which notice expires, the date on which the dismissal takes effect if there's no notice, and if somebody is on a fixed term contract, the relevant date for the purposes of redundancy will be the date at the end of the fixed term contract, so the expiry of the fixed term contract. As long as an employee meets the criteria for payment of redundancy, they would normally receive a statutory redundancy payment. There are, however, some exceptions. The first being an employee's unreasonable refusal of alternative employment. Now, I talked about this in part 4 of the redundancy series, so in the last episode. So if you want to know more, I would suggest you go back and listen. But basically, if an employee unreasonably refuses a suitable offer of alternative employment, then they may forego the right to statutory redundancy pay. If you're an employer and you find yourself in that sort of situation and you're unsure about whether you should be making a redundancy payment or not, each case is decided on the facts. There's no hard and fast rules about this. So it's worth listening back to their last episode, but more importantly, I would recommend that you get some specific advice about your situation before you refuse to pay, or in fact pay because you may be paying and you don't need to. So it's definitely worth getting some advice. The second situation in which an employee may not be entitled to a redundancy payment is where the employee has failed to work their notice period. So in order to qualify for a redundancy payment, an employee must remain at work or employed for the minimum period of their notice, which is set out in law or in their contract. This means that if the employee's contract, for instance, states that the employer is required to give them 4 weeks' notice to terminate their employment, but in fact, the employer gives 8 weeks' notice. So let's just say you go for a redundancy situation, you select your employees for redundancy, you give them notice, but actually you need them to continue to work to fulfil a final contract before their employment ends. And in fact, you've given them 8 weeks' notice rather than the normal 4. In those circumstances, if the employee gives written notice that their employment will end at the end of the 4 weeks' contractual notice period, then they need only work for 4 weeks and they would retain their entitlement to redundancy pay. In those circumstances, as the employer, you can serve a counter notice requiring them to withdraw their notice and remain in employment until the end of your notice period. And you would state in that notice that you would contest any liability for redundancy pay if they failed to work it. If that's the scenario and the employee does not work out the full 8 weeks after you've given them that counter notice, then you may not have to pay them the full amount of redundancy. But what the employee can do is apply to the employment tribunal for an appropriate payment. So the employment tribunal will assess what payment would be appropriate for the employee in the circumstances that would be just and equitable. So just to recap on that point, in the event that an employee fails to work their full notice period, it could mean that you can legitimately refuse to pay them redundancy pay. Now, whether you decide to do this or not is something I would consider carefully. My advice in these circumstances is, wherever possible, to give employees the minimum amount of notice required and, if at all possible, try to reach an agreement with them so that you, one, can plan your workforce and plan what's actually happening with the business, but two, come to some form of amicable agreement about how you're going to deal with the redundancy payments in those circumstances. It's much better to try to reach an agreement with them, and often where it's safer for your business not to have somebody there who could potentially be causing more problems for you. The third scenario in which you may not be required to pay a redundancy payment and which an employee may not be eligible for one is where an employee is dismissed for gross misconduct before the termination for redundancy takes effect. In those circumstances, I suppose it goes without saying that their employment would be terminated by reason of gross misconduct rather than redundancy, and so they wouldn't be eligible for a redundancy payment. I need to caveat this by saying that in the event that you have given notice to terminate an employee's employment by reason of redundancy, and then you find out that they've been doing something which warrants gross misconduct in the meantime, so during their notice period, and you decide to dismiss them, it may be that an employment tribunal could decide on all the circumstances of the case that it would still be just and equitable for you to make some form of appropriate payment to the employee. So it doesn't necessarily follow that just because it's gross misconduct, you will not have to pay the redundancy payment at all. The employee may challenge it. Now, of course, you need to take a view on this, and it all depends on the circumstances of the case. Now, it may not seem entirely fair that an employee does something which would constitute gross misconduct and then could still be entitled to redundancy pay, but it is a risk. And as with these other things, if you are thinking about this and you're in this circumstance, it's definitely worth getting some advice about how you handle the process and whether you make some form of payment to them or not in order to avoid an employment tribunal. Of course, it will depend on the amounts involved here. And a lot of the time, my employer clients take a commercial decision. They make a commercial decision to say, well, actually, it's much cheaper if I pay them a half of what I would have paid them for redundancy anyway, and avoid the need to go through the employment tribunal and pay for costs and all of those sorts of things and the stress and the hassle of it. But before you make that decision, I'd recommend that you take some advice. Finally, it's also worth noting that there are different rules for striking employees, and you should seek some specific advice about that if it arises in your organisation. How do you calculate redundancy pay? Well, there is a statutory formula, as I say, it's set out by law, and it's based on an employee's age, their length of service, and their salary. So what you do is you find out their age, and there's a multiplier for their age, and then for their continuous service, so it's full years of service. And then it's times by their gross weekly pay, which is subject to a maximum, which is currently £475, but that does rise each year with inflation. So for employees who are aged 41 or over, for each year they're aged 41 or over, it's 1.5 times. So if somebody starts work age 42 and they're employed for 3 years, then the multiplier that you would use is 4.5. So you do 4.5 times their gross weekly salary. For somebody who's aged 22 to 40, or during the years that someone's aged 22 to 40, it's 1, so it's 1 time. And then for anyone under 22, it's half. So for example, you've got an employee who's been employed for 3 years and they are aged 21. The multiplier in that circumstance would be 1.5. Now, it's subject to a cap. The maximum continuous service which is included in the calculation is 20 years. So somebody who's been employed for more than 20 years, they won't have any more than 20 years service included in the calculation. The way in which you calculate a week's pay depends on the employee's hours and how they're paid normally. So in the most simple example, you've got an employee who has normal hours and normal pay. Somebody's on a salary who works 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, for instance. Then their week's pay is their basic pay without bonuses or commissions. And it's the regular pay that they receive, basically. That's fairly easy and straightforward. Where you have somebody who has normal hours, so they've got the same set hours every week, but they have different pay, so their pay varies depending on the time of day or the type of work that they do. In that situation, you work out the average of the 12 previous working weeks. And in that circumstance, you include things like commission. So you work out what their average is over the last 12 working weeks. And for somebody who doesn't have any normal hours or normal pay, so let's just say somebody, for instance, who's on a 0-hour contract or who works shifts as and when required, then you work out the previous 12 weeks they were paid. And that would include things like commission and overtime, etc. So that's a scenario where you take a 0-hour contract person and over the last 15 weeks, they've maybe worked 12 of those, but the last three before the redundancy termination, they did no hours, so they had no pay. You wouldn't take those three into consideration. You'd go back to the last 12 in which they receive pay in order to calculate the average for them. As I said, you calculate it based on gross pay, and there is a tax-free exemption, so employees can get that statutory redundancy payment tax-free, and it's covered by section 401 to 416 of the Income Tax Earnings and Pensions Act 2003, and you can get an exemption up to £30,000 there. The very maximum statutory redundancy payment that could be paid to an employee is £14,250 currently, and as I say, that changes each year, normally in April, so I would imagine, as normal, that will go up slightly from April 2016. Although I don't have any of the details at the moment. And when it comes to calculating redundancy pay, employees are legally entitled to a statement which sets out how their payment has been calculated. And surprisingly, it's actually a criminal offence not to provide this, which could be subject to a fine. So it's really important that you include that in your paperwork when you're dealing with the redundancy. We've looked at the eligibility for redundancy pay, circumstances in which redundancy pay need not be paid, how you calculate redundancy pay, and you work out the week's pay. Now, what happens then if there's a dispute about any of those things? Well, if there's a dispute about redundancy pay, there is a statutory presumption, so a legal presumption, that it is a redundancy situation and redundancy pay should be paid. And therefore, it is for the employer to rebut that presumption. So an employee asserts they're entitled to a redundancy payment, the employment tribunal's default position is yes, they are, and then it's for the employer to show facts or circumstances which mean that they're not. So for example, an employee is dismissed for capability and they believe actually it's a redundancy situation and they make a claim to the employment tribunal for redundancy pay. Now in those circumstances, the employment tribunal, as I said, will assume it's redundancy pay and it will be for the employer to show that the dismissal was for some other reason. So it would be for the employer to show that actually it wasn't redundancy but capability, and they'll have to produce evidence to show that. Now employees, unlike most employment tribunal claims, have 6 months in which to make a claim for redundancy pay rather than the normal three. What should also be noted is that employees cannot legally waive their right to a redundancy payment. So you can't put a clause in an employee's contract, for instance, which says that they're not entitled to redundancy pay. Now, it's not so much common practice these days, but I have seen it in previous contracts where somebody's on a fixed term contract and there's a clause which says they're not entitled to redundancy pay because they're on a fixed term contract. Now, that wouldn't be legally binding, and an employee would still be able to pursue a claim for redundancy payment in those circumstances. There are a couple of situations in which the right to redundancy pay can be waived legitimately, and one of those is a settlement agreement. The other is via the ACAS conciliation, so an ACAS agreement. And general employee rights to redundancy can be waived by a collective contract, which is negotiated by the unions in some circumstances. And if an employee has taken up the option of employee shareholder status, which was something that came in 2013, where an employee could take shares in the business in return for waiving some of their employment rights. One of those rights they can waive is statutory redundancy pay. So that's the situations in which redundancy pay can be waived, fairly limited. Now, finally, when we're talking about statutory redundancy pay, There are circumstances in which an employer cannot pay or refuses to pay for some reason. Normally what happens is if an employer is insolvent or there's not enough money in the business to pay, then an employee can make an application to the National Insurance Fund for payment. And the scenarios in which they can do that is, as I say, when an employer refuses to pay and the employee has taken all reasonable steps short of legal proceedings to recover their redundancy pay, and they've still been able to do this, so they can go to the National Insurance Fund, and if the employer is insolvent. Now, an employee in these circumstances will use the form RP1, and they must show that they have the eligibility for a payment and that the employer is liable to make the payment to them. And also they must show that they've taken all reasonable steps to try to get the money back themselves. If an employee or employees make an application to the National Insurance Fund, then the Secretary of State may require the employer to provide information and documents in order that they can assess eligibility for redundancy pay. In those circumstances, it would be a criminal offence for an employer to fail to comply. So again, if you find yourself in this situation, you should certainly seek some advice fairly quickly to ensure that you've done everything that you need to avoid any liability. Okay, so that's an overview there of the statutory, so the legal minimum requirements for redundancy pay. Now, there are some circumstances in which employers will pay an enhanced redundancy payment, and that can be in two scenarios, really. One is where it's a contractual or legally obliged payment, so it's contained in employees' contracts or handbooks, or it's been collectively agreed with unions, for instance. Or it's where an employer makes a payment at their discretion. So you decide you want to reward the loyalty of some key employees who've been with you for a while and you want to pay them slightly more than the statutory minimum. In those circumstances, it's known as enhanced redundancy. Now, what employers should note in this situation is that there may be circumstances in which enhanced redundancy pay becomes an implied term of an employee's contract. It might not expressly state that you will pay enhanced redundancy, but over a period of time, it can become custom and practice that you pay enhanced redundancy. And so an employee may have a claim to say that they're legally entitled to that enhanced payment. There have been several cases in which employees have challenged their employer as to whether enhanced redundancy payment terms have become implied into their contracts of employment. And so if you have the habit or are regularly paying enhanced redundancy payments to your employees, it's worth obtaining some advice or getting an idea about whether in future, if you decided to stop doing that, you could be liable for making those payments in any event as a contractual obligation. So for now, I would just say be aware that it's a situation that could arise if you decide to, or you have in the past paid at your discretion, and get some advice in the event that you decide to move forward with a redundancy process in the future. Finally, as I round off, there are some online tools available for calculating statutory redundancy pay. I know that lots of employers find this difficult and the calculation can be complicated when working out ages and dates. And I'll put a link in my show notes, which you can find on the website adviceforemployers.co.uk/podcast/44. I'll put a link there to the government's online, what we call Ready Reckoner. So you basically just put in the information and it works out for you. It makes life a whole lot simpler when you're trying to calculate statutory redundancy pay. And it also ensures that you have the up-to-date rates on there for the current limits on weeks pay and that sort of thing. As with all of the things I talk about on the podcast, if you find yourself in an odd scenario or you're not entirely sure about whether your business fits in one particular area or the scenario that you're talking about with employees and redundancy, you're not sure if you have to pay them or not, all those sorts of things, please just take some advice before you decide to take action. It's much easier to deal with it at the outset than to try to rectify it later on. So on that note, if you would like some specific legal advice, you can contact me directly. It's alison@realemploymentlawadvice.co.uk and I'd be happy to work with you. I work with clients throughout the UK. You don't have to be based on the South Coast, which is where I'm based. I can help you out wherever you are. So do not hesitate to contact me. As this is my final episode before Christmas, I would like to take this opportunity to say a big thank you to everybody who's listened and who supports the podcast. I'm really grateful for your support. It makes all the hard work every week worthwhile. I want to wish you and your families a very Merry Christmas and a happy and prosperous 2016. I will be back with another podcast on the 28th of December, which is the final part of this redundancy sequence. And then I will be taking a short break for 2 weeks and I'll be back again after that with a brand new episode of the podcast. Many thanks for listening and have a great week. Thanks again for listening. Just want to finalise by saying I wouldn't be a lawyer unless I had a legal disclaimer. So I must just say to you that the information in this podcast is for information only. It's a general review and a general update. It's always necessary to get specific legal advice about your circumstances. So please don't rely on anything that you've heard in this podcast. But please do feel free to contact me if you'd like further information or specific advice.